League of Legends is a terrible game.
Then why are you continuing to play it every single night?
It's like an addiction.
The VGRT Gaming Podcast, episode 317, recorded on July 16th, 2013. Welcome to the 317th edition of the TD Gaming Podcast and the 150th episode of Video Game Roundtable. I am Jonah Falcon.
And I am Jordan Lund.
VGRT Gaming Podcast focuses on game news from the industry and includes listener feedback, gaming flashback, and gaming history.
So 150.
Yeah. And we got the whole kit and caboodle today because we have a gaming flashback and a gaming history.
When did I start on this? I can't believe it's 150 already.
Well, I believe the first time you ever appeared on the podcast was when we were getting your opinion on the Sony outage, maybe? On April 2011? No.
I don't remember.
It has to be earlier than that, maybe.
Before that.
Well, I know that you did a special episode, and then you joined around 10 or 9. So.
Yeah. Been a while.
Yeah, so well, we'll celebrate by having both a gaming flashback and a gaming history, but what have you been playing?
I sat down and finished off Infamous 2. It had been sitting here unfinished, and I finished it.
Did you get a good ending or a bad ending?
I did the good ending.
Okay. And the good ending isn't all that good anyway, so, yeah.
I was surprised. Yeah, it was surprisingly dark for a good ending.
Yeah. Anyways, too bad Paul isn't here, because I think he was a fan of the old Sierra adventure games. Were you? I forgot.
I played some of them. I did not play Police Quest, but I enjoyed Manhunter and Manhunter 2.
Okay, well, speaking of which, this week's gaming flashback is Police Quest. Take it away, Jordan.
Police Quest in Pursuit of the Death Angel is an adventure game and police simulation produced by Jim Walls for Sierra Online and originally released in 1987, built for their AGI.
On their AGI.
Sorry. Released in 1987, built on their AGI, it was remade in 1992 using 256-color VGA graphics and the SCI engine, which dramatically improved the appearance and audio of the game and replaced the command line interface with point and click.
Whoa, 256 colors, man.
I know. You're getting rid of a command line.
Yeah, just wait until they get EGA. Oh, wait. No, EGA came after. It came before VGA.
Yeah, EGA was before. EGA was 16 colors.
Yeah.
The game was released on MS-DOS, Amiga, Atari ST, Apple II, and Apple II GS. It was the first game of the Police Quest series that spawned two direct sequels, Police Quest II, The Vengeance, and Police Quest III, The Kindred, as well as Police Quest Open Season, Police Quest SWAT, and Police Quest SWAT 2. It's also worth pointing out that this is basically a branch from King's Quest, which predated Police Quest.
Yeah. By the way, I really loved the SWAT games. You know, it became a first-person tactical shooter. And the best part was everything was randomized. So you just couldn't, you know, and you didn't know who who might attack you. That's why you had to handcuff everybody.
The latter two games were continued in the SWAT. The Police Quest in Pursuit of the Death Angel is an adventure game whose gameplay is centered around interacting with the environment to resolve a series of scenarios. These largely revolve around typical police work such as securing crime scenes and recovering stolen vehicles, plus some important duty procedures. The original release of the game required the player to type in the desired actions such as opening doors, pressing buttons, or firing one's gun, while the remake allows the player to use the mouse to select actions from a menu and objects from the environment. The lack of traditional puzzles made the game stand out at the time of release, although it was resulted in some criticism of the dry police work. Unlike many games of the genre, the style and play depends largely on a strict adherence to the standard police rules and procedure. Failure to abide by proper procedure typically leads to the player being penalized on points or having his character killed. For instance, if a main character, Sonny, neglects to store his sidearm in a gun locker before entering the jail to book a prisoner, the prisoner will take the gun from him the moment his handcuffs are removed and shoot him with it, ending the game. Police Quest 1 was reported to have been used as a training tool for police officers. According to Rich DeBon, Interaction Magazine's Spring 1992, Police Quest has proven to be a practical, effective training tool officers enjoy using. It safely demonstrates to rookies the consequences of failing to observe proper police procedures and can serve as a valuable refresher course for experienced officers. Creator Jim Wells has started development of a spiritual sequel, Precinct, on Kickstarter.
Right, and that was announced actually today. So they're bringing it back, and it looks very interesting, and I'm probably going to back it. And the thing about it is that Police Quest and also SWAT 4, you know, the first of the first-person tactical shooters, offered you to check if you were faced up against a suspect. What you had to do is you had to raise your gun and command them to freeze, you know, and stand still and all that stuff. If you ever shot the suspect, you got penalized, you know, because you're not supposed to fire on suspects, especially if they're...
You're a cop, right?
Yeah, even if they're armed, you have to scream, freeze, drop your gun several times before you realize that they're not going to pay attention to you.
Rules of engagement, right?
And shooting a suspect while they're handcuffed gets you cashiered. That's definitely a no-no. And also, what's interesting is that you have to handcuff everybody. And in SWAT 4, it was funny to hear this one of them grumble that he's the mayor's aide, and you'll be hearing from him. You don't care. You just handcuff him. You can unhandcuff him when you're sure everybody is okay. So.
Sierra Online had a rich history, probably second only to Infocom as far as, you know, adventure games.
A lot of the big names, Jane Jensen, Roberta Williams, you know. Anyways, we can go down memory lane for as long as we want, but we're going to move on to game news. And Blizzard announces Diablo 3 coming to Xbox One and PS4 in 2014. This comes to us from Diablo fans. Gamers interested in getting Diablo 3 for the PlayStation 3 or the Xbox 360 but are planning to pick up a next-gen machine may want to hold off on their purchase, as Blizzard has announced that the Xbox One and PlayStation 4 versions of Diablo 3 will be coming in 2014. According to Diablo fans, the Diablo 3 team has actually received the new console generation development kits. That's kind of late, isn't it?
I think it is kind of late if they're just getting it now, yeah.
Yeah, well, that explains what's going to be in 2014. So the translation to those platforms is yet to be done. They really like the features on the PS4 controller and want to try and do something cool with a trackpad and share button. The Diablo 3 will not be a launch date title for the next generation consoles, obviously, so it'll come in 2014. The current gen versions of Diablo 3 will be arriving on September 9th of this year. So, if you are getting a PS4 or whatever, Jordan, is that going to make you hold off buying the current gen version of Diablo 3?
I think the money that I don't spend on games, I think in terms of pure budgetary reasons, I would end up waiting till 2014. I've waited this long for Diablo 3. I can wait a little bit longer.
I did play Diablo 3 on the PlayStation 3 back in New York Comic Con, and it's a lot better. For one thing, it's been made so it feels more at home with the console. Like you can duck and roll, you know, and dodge and all that. And of course, all of them are going to be dumping the auction house, and they're going to have an offline mode. What's interesting is that the PS4 and the Xbox One are both very highly internet tuned, right? They're going to have a lot of internet connectivity, but they're probably not going to have an always online mode, you know.
I can't imagine they will, and you know, they could do an always online with the PS3 and the 360 as well if they wanted
that. The thing is that, you know what, people are going to go online to play multiplayer anyway, you know,
right?
And isn't it funny how the departure of certain higher-ups actually made the Diablo 3 team say, well, yeah, remember when we said that online was integral to the experience? Well, it wasn't really. It was actually forced on us. So,
yeah, exactly.
You know, and Jay Wilson said so himself after he'd been cursing out the Diablo 2 developer, you know, for, I think it was, it's sort of, you know, the queen doth protest too much. I think he was agreeing, but you know, was frustrated.
I think it's probably a good thing for them to move out of. You know, I would possibly even delay Diablo 3 to next year and just have a global release for all the consoles in 2014, simply because the gaming dollar is going to be stretched tight this fall.
Two
new console releases plus two new launch. Well,
not everybody's going to be buying a launch console.
Everybody's going to be buying a launch console. They're exactly not.
Well, you know, on off news, and I didn't write any news items on this because, you know, there's a lot of news items this week, a lot of really important. And the other one is that the Xbox One has been selling out at GameStop, not GameSpot. It would be odd if the Xbox One sold out at GameSpot. Amazon and GameSpot and Best Buy, you know, so it seems like there's going to be a healthy number of Xbox Ones being sold. And this is all before the Gamescom appearance of the Xbox One, where they're going to have that big important announcement. It's probably going to be the release date, but maybe something else. I remember when you sent me the poll, it says, well, 88%, you know, I don't have no idea what that poll was supposed to mean. The PS4 was going to outsell the Xbox One by 88 to 12. It doesn't work that way.
The interest among gamers outweighs the Xbox One by about a 12-to-1 margin.
You see, how much does it cost to vote in a poll?
It doesn't cost anything to vote.
Well, there you go. The thing is that what this indicates to me is that, you know, like I said, the number of consoles that developers are really worried about is enough that if you release your game on a console, it's going to sell. Right, and
my prediction for the Xbox One launch is that there's going to be a lot of very disappointed scalpers on launch day.
Well, no one's going to be. I can't believe that anybody's going to pay $20,000 for a PS4 on eBay. That has to be a prank in which one guy and another guy are basically, you know, bumping up the price artificially for that.
No, I'm sure. $20,000
for a launch console. I don't care if it's the Neo Geo. You know. But here's the thing is that it isn't enough that you have a lot of consoles. What matters is the attach rate, right? And one thing about Microsoft gamers is that they've always been game buyers. You know, they've always had a high attach rate. That's right. Why the Wii and the Wii U have tumbled so badly is that they have a miserable, almost unheard of low attach rate. You know, and that's what also hurt the PS.
People bought the Wii, they were happy with their sports resort, and they'd never bought another game.
That, you know, and that's what hurt the PS3 in the very beginning, you know, was the low attach rate. It went up, you know, as the console matured. But, you know, I think the reason why the Xbox One is selling out is because it's been such a long wait for a new console. You know, it's been such a long wait that people just want the new hotness, you know. And the other thing is that, you know, and obviously, people want their Xbox Live accounts to transfer over, you know. So, all developers care about is, okay, are there consoles to sell for, and are they going to buy our game if we put it out there? So, I mean, and I'm pretty sure that all the third party developers are pleased as punch with that. Now, the reason why we went in this order is because I wanted to get your impression of this next news item. Go ahead, Jordan.
Dyak attempts to get Shadow of the Eternals off the ground with Kickstarter again. This comes to us from Strategy Informer. Dennis Dyak studio Precursor Games has announced that it will put Shadow of the Eternals back on Kickstarter, despite the trials the studio has been going through, not the least of which found one of its founders in disturbing legal trouble. According to the developer on its site, quote, "Numerous suggestions about the first campaign were given to us by our community, and we listened. At this point, we're not ready to talk about what has changed, but it's safe to say that it's a great deal. We look forward to discussing these changes more in the near future. Shadow of the Eternals is the spiritual successor to the GameCube classic Eternal Darkness, which was developed by Dyak's former studio Silicon Knights. The new game, well, it says will be released, in theory will be released on PC and Wii. In episodic form sometime in 2014.
Now, by the way, that disturbing legal trouble was one of the founders was caught in a child pornography ring, which is very bizarre.
This was not Dyak that got caught.
No, it wasn't Dyak, or else he wouldn't be starting the Kickstarter again. I'm gonna wager that one of the suggestions, the overwhelming suggestions by fans was lower that Kickstarter goal by about tenfold, please. you don't need to spend, you don't need to raise that much money for this, because from what I understand from you, the gameplay demo that they released wasn't much different from the original game.
No, it was exactly the church level from the game. If anybody remembers the church level, it was the church level. And it was neat seeing it again, but you know, all they really did was update the textures on it.
So, how do you feel about an episodic Eternal Darkness, which is basically what this is, you know, because they don't own the rights to the title,
to the name? Yeah. I think it's fine. I enjoyed Eternal Darkness. I would like to see a follow up to it. Episodic content is interesting. I got the new episode for Walking Dead last night. Haven't really had a chance to play it yet, so you know that'll be what you play next week.
I think it's very kind of touching that they're remaining loyal to the Nintendo brand and having the Wii version also being. I think it doesn't take much to port it over to the Wii, and it'll just be a PC port. But you know, it's interesting that they're going that route.
Well, it says here in the article Wii. Don't they mean Wii U?
No, well, Wii and Wii U are compatible.
Well, they are compatible, but I mean,
they're making it for the Wii. They're not making it for the Wii U. But then again, my extension is for the Wii U, too.
I thought originally the plan was to do it on the Wii U.
No, it's for Wii.
Because that was one of the things that made me consider buying a Wii U, was that it was originally going to be a Wii U title.
Well, you can just keep your old Wii for this. I mean, if we're wrong, you can always check the Kickstarter thing. It's gonna launch on the 25th. We can't really say anything about it now because it's over a week from now.
Right.
But, the thing about Eternal Darkness and Shadow of Eternals is the one thing that everybody's going to be wondering is how they're going to screw with the interface, you know, when you're going insane. Because that was the best part of the game. And also, I believe the Cthulhu game that was released on Xbox, remember? I think that also had some of that as well.
Dark Corners of the Earth. Yeah. That was just a terrible use of the Lovecraft license. I felt really bad playing that game.
But, you know, how come there aren't many games? I mean, well, there is a game called Cthulhu Saves the World, but that's a parody and a comedy, which is actually pretty good. If you want to check it out on Steam or Xbox Live Indie, go ahead and check it out. But it's not a true, you know, Lovecraftian game. It's just a paying homage to it.
Right.
Okay, we're going to move on to the next item. U.S. recognizes League of Legends as a professional sport, and this comes to us from Eurogamer. The U.S. government has officially recognized League of Legends as a professional sport, which will allow foreign players to get visas to work in the United States. According to Riot Games esports manager Nick Allen, the U.S. government recognizes League of Legends pro players as professional athletes and awards visas to essentially work in the United States under that title. This is groundbreaking for esports, he added. Having foreign players competing in the U.S. will be far easier for them. We can start looking for international players when they come over. It's a lot easier process because they've actually been recognized by the government. This was a lengthy process. We had a lot of people fighting for this. It wasn't something that happened overnight. The ruling is timely since the Season 3 World Champion for League of Legends will start on the 16th September in Los Angeles, and the first place winner will win $1 million. And I'm interested to hear if Alan would pipe up about playing in a professional sport now.
Alan is a League of Legends player. Alan, what's your ranking right now?
That's hard to explain to people who don't play League of Legends. Silver 2, for anybody that actually listens to this, they'll know.
Okay, but you're not going to be competing anytime soon in major.
Silver 2. I don't know what that means, but
yeah, I'm not a pro at all.
These words sound like English.
but
every time I hear Alan playing, it reminds me of that More Dots video for World of Warcraft. More dots, more dots. DPS, DPS.
You know the thing is
what
that.
What the fuck? More the dots.
The thing is that StarCraft 2 does a lot more, but I don't think anybody really needs to get visas for that because they're all in South Korea. You know, that's even more a professional sport than League of Legends. But for people whose eyebrows raise at this being a professional sport, I might remind them there's another professional sport which requires even less effort, physical effort than this. People seem to forget that chess is considered a professional sport.
That's true. So, and there are scholarships for chess.
Wait. You're very faint.
I said there are scholarships.
No, I think you have to talk into your mic.
I am talking into the mic.
There you go.
There are scholarships for chess. I wonder if there will be scholarships for video games.
It might take a bit, but at some point, you know, the thing is that A lot of gamers made a living off of first-person shooter tourneys, you know?
That's true.
You know, like Reigns became famous for his Quake abilities and... Not Reigns, I'm sorry. That's Origin. That's Ultima Online. Fatality, that's right. Fatality was the one who...
Fatality became famous for spawn camping, yes.
Yeah, Reigns was famous for killing Lord British. But, you know, it's an interesting step. I mean, one thing you have to understand is, and I'm pretty sure Alan knows this, is that live streams have professional announcers and they get millions of hit, you know, viewers. So it's something that us old fogies don't notice happening, but it's happening.
For the record, Jonah.
Yes.
League of Legends is a terrible game, and I recommend that people not play it.
Well, guess
what? Why are you continuing to play it every single night?
It's like an addiction. But for the record, like, if you're going to play a MOBA, go play Dota 2. Like, get into that. It's actually a way better game.
Yeah, but you know what? Well, MOBAs are the big thing right now because the Infinite Crisis MOBA has been getting a lot of positive feedback. You also have the Guardians of Middle-Earth MOBA, which is...
The genre itself isn't particularly good. Like, I'm a bad person for playing League of Legends.
Well, here's the thing is that one of the thing about MOBAs is that there's a barrier there for new players. If you better practice a lot because if you don't play well, you're going to get berated five ways from Sunday.
Oh, yeah. One person can screw the game up and people will gang report them to the ground if they screw up too badly. So, yes.
And if you get too cranked out about it, you'll end up in solitary in prison.
Pretty much.
Oh.
Yeah, there was one kid who was goaded into threatening another player.
Well, that's nothing.
That player then reported him, and the kid got arrested. He's currently sitting in jail.
But you remember the news way back when Riot Games banned those players for racist mutterings. They were banned for life, and another, you know. And also recently, they had actually had a team throw it. You also had a team betting on themselves to lose, that sort of thing, or betting on the sport when they shouldn't be. So yeah, I mean it's getting there. One of the things that's interesting to note, by the way, is that Riot Games was declared the fourth best tech company to work for in the world.
Interesting.
And I'm going to tell you this: they have the best parties at PAX and E3.
Nice.
They just invite everybody, and they always have great bar food. So if you want your wings, you want your hot dogs, you know, you want your fries, you know, just go to the Riot Games party, even if you're not.
I never went to any of the parties. I'm not a party kind of guy.
But are you a food kind of guy?
Yeah.
Well, then there you go.
less so now that I have the diabetes.
Well, bar food doesn't tend to have any effect on diabetes, really.
It's the sauces.
Okay. Again, I'm really interested to see how you react to this this item, Jordan. Go ahead.
Sony drops fine appeal levied due to 2011 April hacker attack from Polygon. Sony has announced that it will drop its appeal against a £250,000 Great British Pound fine levied by the Information Commissioner's Office, ICO, in Britain for the company's failure to warn its 77 million customers that their personal data for about a week after the PlayStation Network had been hacked in April 2011, forcing Sony to shut down PSN for weeks.
By the way, before we move on, £250,000 Great British Pounds, I believe, is $375,000.
Probably about that, yeah. The fine was levied due to Sony's inability to keep said user info safe. When the fine was announced, ICO's David Smith criticized, quote, "If you're responsible for so many payment card details and login details, then keeping that personal data secure has to be your priority. In this case, that just didn't happen. When the database was targeted, albeit in a determined criminal attack, the security measures in place were simply not good enough." Sony immediately appealed the decision, but have now withdrew it. According to the company in a press statement, quote, "After careful consideration, we are withdrawing our appeal. This decision reflects our commitment to protect the confidentiality of our network security from disclosure. In the course of proceeding, we continue to disagree with the decision on the merits." On the careful consideration comes 18 months after the fine was first levied.
Yeah, the fine was first levied, I believe, in January. I'm not sure if the article says that. January 2012. Jordan, go ahead, since you were the one that's your information.
Since my information was stolen. Yeah, I think it's a good thing that Sony is withdrawing the appeal. I think the appeal, pretty much anytime there's a case like this, an appeal is automatic. So it didn't surprise me that they appealed it. I'm kind of surprised that they let it go this long because they obviously screwed up. They obviously admitted that they screwed up, and they took 2 weeks to notify anybody. Not only that, but during the two-week period, I was locked out of PSN. I couldn't even find out which one of my cards was compromised.
Did you say that,
which was the larger problem for me.
Didn't you say that your card was being used in Germany?
My card was being used in Germany at one point.
Yeah.
That was actually not related to Sony. That was related to a hack against Subway, which is a whole other deal. The primary issue is, yes, anybody can be targeted. Sony apparently did not take the proper precautions that is required of anybody taking credit card information over the internet.
But, you know, as bad as that is, that's kind of forgivable, you know. I mean, yeah, it's shitty security, you know, and they should be blamed for that. But I think the real crime came from not telling their customers that they'd been broken into.
Not telling anyone for 2 weeks and locking us out so we couldn't find out what was going on. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I have to wonder, because you know that PSN updates like once every 2 weeks these days. I think it's like a constant battle for them to keep on securing their system, because they always say it's maintenance, but we all know it's a security update.
Well, security and I'm sure they're probably doing something to lock out hacked firmware and stuff.
Yeah. So... And the thing is that I have to believe that with the pre-orders of the PS4, Sony just said, you know what, we're going to make up the money anyway, so we might as well drop it now. I think it was sort of like a delaying tactic, just waiting to see how the PS4 was going to do. They might have dropped it earlier if the Vita actually sold. You know,
I think the Vita sales are going to pick up, Jonah.
Yeah.
I don't think the Vita sales are going to pick up simply because there aren't any Vita games.
Well, guess what? The Wii U has less games than the Vita actually outsold it.
That's true.
Yeah. Well, it's going to have games. It's not going to have Vita exclusive games. You had this gripe last week. As a matter of fact, for the past 2 weeks, you've made.
It will have all of the PS4 games.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to move on to the last news item for this week. Microsoft family sharing may return to Xbox One in some form. This also comes to us from Polygon. Microsoft corporate vice president Mark Whitten has revealed in some of the features that were lost when the always-on policy of the Xbox One were removed may return, such as family sharing. According to Whitten in an interview with IGN, if there's something that people are really excited about and want, we're going to make sure that we find the right way to bring it back. The only obstacle is finding a way to do it without the copy protection the Xbox One would have had. Taking family share out of the launch window was not about we're going to take our toys and go home or something like that, he explained. It was just sort of logistics of how do we make this very, very clear request that people really want and that choice, and how do we make sure that we can do an excellent job of that, get to launch, and then be able to build a bunch of great features. In the future, I think you're going to see the ways that we can change how you discover, how you consume, share, play. The Xbox One will be playable both at San Diego Comic-Con, which is next week. And, you know, I've never been to the San Diego Comic-Con. I've been to the New York Comic-Con, but everybody tells me I should go to the San Diego Comic-Con.
San Diego is about twice the size of New York Comic-Con.
Yeah. And Gamescom 2013 in August. So what I don't understand is what they could have done was sort of have a Switch. You know, when you first plug in your Xbox One, you're asked, listen, okay, you have a choice, this or this. You can have it always on, or you can just have this one-time check, and then you don't have to be online anymore. However, if you have it always on, you can have these features. If you don't, well, you'll have these features.
How about this? How about all of the stuff they wanted to do as far as copy protection applies to digitally purchased copies only and not on disc copies?
That's true. I mean, I think that's what Sony is actually doing. I'm not sure. But for the people who don't know what the family sharing was that what it meant is that 10 people would declare themselves family, right? You know, our little circle. And when you bought in the old system, whenever you bought a game, whatever game it was for the Xbox One, you'd get a digital copy of it automatically, and it'd be stored on the cloud, right? And you could go to any of your people in your family, log on to your account, and boom, your game is there waiting for you. As a matter of fact, they get to share in your game as well. the only caveat is sort of like in Steam, two people can't play the same game at the same time. So if you want to play multiplayer with each other, it's not going to work unless you buy another copy, you know. But if you have a single player game, you know, you can share as much as you want. You just can't play it, that game with that other person at the same time, you know. So that was what was going to happen. Now you just trade around your disc. But a lot of people, you know, and it's funny, it's like damned if you, damned if you don't, you know. People are saying, we don't want online DRM. And then as soon as that's taken away, it's like other people say, well, wait, we wanted that. Why are you taking it away from us? And you had a, you actually have a petition of thousands of people demanding that they put it back again, you know.
One of the petitions has already been shut down. It only got about 1,800 votes, and it's done.
The other one is a couple thousand.
The other one's a couple thousand.
I think the other one is only because it was superfluous. You know, two same petitions.
Well, and if you look at the signatures, there were so many.
There were some people who were sarcastic, yes, but sarcastic, a lot of people weren't. So, I mean, I was. You weren't, but I was fine with the original scheme. You know.
No, I was not okay with the original scheme at all.
Yeah, I know you weren't, but I was, you know, but it's fine, you know. I mean, my take is that if I'm getting an Xbox One, I just want a lot of other people buying it so that I can get the games that I want, you know, because that's my only concern is that there's enough people that third-party developers say, okay, we'll release for your thing, because right now the Wii U, like we already said, who wants to
develop? If you don't have a user base, the developer, it's not a case if you build it, they will come, you know. They have to buy it, then they will come.
Because that, by the way, that's why the Dreamcast had so much third-party support even after it was discontinued. Because there was a rabid fan base that just loved their Dreamcast, and they bought the games when they came out. You know?
Yeah, the Sega sold lots of the hardware. The problem was that they lost money on every single sale.
What's funny is that Sonic the Hedgehog now belongs to Nintendo.
Well, it's still a Sega property.
It's no longer a Sega property. Sega sold it to them. They said, here, take it. We don't want it. You want it? You can have them. It's strange.
I thought they just sold the publishing rights. That's not the same thing as selling the character.
And what's also funny is that Sega has decided they're not going to do console games anymore. They're going to focus on PC development, which is interesting because they do have some really, 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 really good PC games like
Total War series.
Yeah, the Total War series, Creative Assembly. I was about to say, they have and some other developers. So. And, you know, I really wish Alpha Protocol had done better because I really like that game. But Sega's not going to do another Alpha Protocol game. So we're going to move on to listener feedback from Paul Pretke at Watch Dogs. The problem with the Microsoft Cloud Computing is similar to the PS Move. If it's not obligatory or bundled with a system, then the install base is lower, so the devs are less inclined to develop for it. Kudos for Ubisoft for taking advantage of the cloud, but it is true that users with slower internet connections, the dynamism may be not as improved as they say. By the way, it isn't just the water, by the way. It's more like if you do something in this part of the city, it affects another part of the city, and it remembers that so that when you go there. Because, you know, a lot of games, you know, if you go to one place and you come back, the bodies have dissolved or gone or whatever, you know, it just like the game resets. You know, in this case, it stays where it is, basically what it's doing. By the way, Ubisoft did say and made it a point to say that the PS4 version would not be GIMPed. There was no value loss on the PS4 version, so... at Sony DualShock 4, I'm pretty sure this can be fixed with a firmware update, or at least I hope it can. And what he's referring to is the fact that there's going to be a light on the PS on the DualShock 4 that was supposed to be a part of the PlayStation Eye. You know, no, it's not. It's a permanent part, and he was quite specific that it's going to be there and it's going to light up. You know, and all that stuff.
They did state that developers will be able to turn the light off in software.
There has to be a hardware option to do that. I understand that it's the software not allowing it at this point. As far as the battery lifetime goes, I have to say I'm satisfied with the DualShock 3. True, it's a pain in the butt, but you can charge it with the system off. Jordan said you can't.
You can't charge it with the system off. You can charge it with the system off if you have a third-party charger hooked into a wall or if you plug it into a laptop.
Yeah. I own two controllers, so if one runs out of juice, I plug it in and use the other one. As a last resort, I could play with a controller plugged in, but it rarely comes to that. Well, if you have a friggin' wireless, why do you even care? I mean, wired. That's why I buy wired controllers, because A, they're cheaper, and B, I don't care if if it's wireless.
Well, the DualShock 4 is not wired by default. You have to buy a long USB cable to hook it in.
Okay. Having said that, I hope it would be possible to charge new controllers with the PlayStation 4 switched off.
I hope so too.
Yeah, at Indian prices, but they said that's right. They said charge it while you're playing. At Indian prices, I agree with Jonah that EA could verify their customers somehow. A credit card would be the easiest way, although a mail-in method would also work. Punishing those people just because some idiots from the other side of the world will take advantage of the system is precisely why EA gets all the quote-unquote accolades. I think that was sarcastic. It gets year in and year out. Hashtag worst company.
What a dig against accolade. That's what I really want to know.
You know, the thing is, they could make it very – what's the word I'm looking for? They could make it very, have them do a really thorough registration because of a one-time thing. And if it's their personal code, they would not want to jeopardize the deal they're getting, So it's sort of like EA says, listen, we're giving you this code. This is your discount code. If we see anybody else but you buying stuff with it, gone forever, and you'll have to pay full price like the rest of the world. I mean, that would be a big enough threat to the average consumer that they would not want to share that code. At Vita, it's true there aren't many or even a few AAA Vita games in development, but I'd like to be more optimistic. I hope that the Vita will gain popularity with the new PlayStation, and once the install base grows, developers will notice it makes more sense to make games for the handheld. Well, here's the thing is that if it's completely compatible with PSN, why make a Vita-only game? That was Jordan's point.
Exactly. The other thing is that the Vita is losing developers. In fact, just today they announced the folks that develop F1 2013 specifically said that there would not be a Vita version simply because it didn't make financial sense.
Let me guess, there's no Wii U version either.
There's no Wii U version either.
Yeah. So, by the way, getting back to the Xbox One and PS4, that's another reason why I think the Xbox One will be okay is because it's sort of like U.S. politics. You have a two-party system here. You're not going to have one console. The last time that happened was the Atari 2600 for a few years and then the Nintendo for a few years. And even that was just short-lived because quickly the Intellivision and the Genesis came out. Also, bringing back older games in this sense makes context for people who buy a PS4 and don't have a PS3 now. The Vita could be a way to experience the great PSN games such as Dead Nation. Yeah! Or Guacamelee. By the way, have you also played Velocity Ultra on the Vita? Look below.
I have not played Velocity Ultra. I will take a look and see what I can find for it. I'm very picky on my PSN games in that I don't play a game unless there's a demo of it, and I don't just run out and buy digital games. I have to see a demo first, and there's not a lot of demos in the PSN marketplace, which is another thing they need to fix for the PS4.
I think there is a demo of Guacamelee. Do you like if you like platformers, Metroidvania, except with a masked Lucador, which is a Mexican wrestler, then Guacamelee might be for you.
I looked for a demo a while back when the game first came out, and I haven't looked recently. There wasn't one the last time I looked.
For the question of the week, and the question of the week was, what indie games do you like the best, or was the best in the past year? I'll have to say Velocity Ultra. It's a great vertical shoot 'em up for the Vita. However, it has a twist in that your ship can teleport through walls and other obstacles. It's easy to learn, difficult to master. It has achievements and trophies, and requires a lot of skill if you want to complete all the stages flawlessly. By the way, I still try and play Ikaruga. It's tough as hell, but that's why they call it a bullet hell game.
I was going to say Ikaruga is the last vertical shooter that I really enjoyed.
Oh, what about Radiant Silvergun?
Genre. I love it.
What about Radiant Silvergun?
I vaguely remember Radiant Silvergun.
It's by the same guys. It's by Treasure as well.
Radiant Silvergun, wasn't that a Saturn game?
No, it was a GameCube game.
Oh, it was a GameCube game.
Yeah, both eager.
I think it was originally a Saturn game.
Oh, maybe our readers will correct us. Okay, we're moving on to the next item. Go take away, Jordan. And you, by the way, you can read both items after this because they're related.
All right. From Arthur the Fifth, dynamism, is that a word? And it reminds me of the Ray Harryhausen. Dynamation! Dynamation!
All I remember is Dynamite Dog with Blue Falcon.
OMFG.
Oh, no, Dynagirl.
It was Dynamic Water. I wonder if it involves advanced fish AI. having a marginally better environment won't sell the console. It sounds like a cool gimmick, but just like in GTA, rushing through the city at high speed, you won't even notice it.
Hold a timeout. How is a third-party game going to sell an entire console? This isn't Grand Theft Auto 3 when Sony bought exclusive rights for a year. You know, this is going to be it's going to be released on every single platform at the same time. Well, not true. I mean, it's going to be released on PC and current gen and then on next gen. But people are not going to buy a PS4 or Xbox One based on Grand Theft Auto 5.
No.
Especially since, and we have this, you know, no matter how great a game is, if
what
the game
saying,
comes out
of what he's saying is that the cloud enhancement of Watch Dogs won't really apply because you'll be moving through the game and will not actually see the benefit of it.
But here's the thing.
That was his comparison to GTA.
But you know what? There's something we like to call watchwords and I forgot what it's called again. Not gimmick words. You know what I'm talking about.
Diesel words?
Buzzword,
yep.
Buzzwords. You know, there are buzzwords that are out there, and if the cloud becomes a buzzword...
The cloud has been a buzzword for years.
I mean, in terms of the Xbox One and the dynamic cloud, you know, and all that.
Dynamation! Dynamation!
Dynamicism.
Now in Dynamation!
How about Electric Girl and Electric Woman and Dyna Girl?
Electro Woman and Dyna Girl. You're the other person that remembers Electro Woman and Dyna Girl.
I never watched it. I just know of it.
Oh, my God. Oh.
I'm sorry. I watched ISIS instead.
Prop people. At Matrick, talking about the Xbox executive who resigned to go to Zynga. At Matrick, if I would not care any harder, I would start sucking in other people's cares and turn UK into a country full of apathetic pricks, i.e. France. I don't tend to place names to faces from the video gaming business. For me, he will always be that smug, short guy who wasted a lot of time on conferences taking crap no one cared about.
But actually, people cared a lot what he had to say, overwhelmingly so. And the thing is that, you know, keep in mind, Don Matrick sold the Xbox 360. So it's, you know, I just think he was distracted by the fact that he knew he was going to be going somewhere else.
I think that, and he said some really incredibly stupid things.
Well, the thing is, he doesn't have to worry about saying stupid things because it wasn't going to be his problem anymore.
Right.
By the way, you know, does this line of talking sound a little Monty Python-ish? You know, when she's going to start affecting a wild French accent, you know. Your mother smelt of elderberries, you know.
At PS controllers, don't care. I bought an adapter that lets me plug in my Xbox 360 and PS2 controllers into my PS3. Haven't used the official PS3 controller ever since. If I get a chance to do so with PS4, I will gladly. DualShock controllers overstayed their welcome, a relic of an era long past that should have been redesigned at the PS3 stage. They tried that. It was called Six Axis. And how did that turn out?
Well, you know what? Just watch out, you know it could have been, you know, the banana controller.
Banana controller, yeah.
And then you had that video with the song of the banana phone.
Banana phone. Na 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 banana phone. At favorite indie game, I played two in the last year. Both of them were ripoffs of another series. Castle Miner Z is a Minecraft clone, which focuses less on building and more on mob survival. It has craftable guns and loads of zombies to shoot. Another game is White Noise, a Slender ripoff, almost the same, but has co-op, which results in some hilarious gags. I tend to turn to indies because a lot of them have co-op support. Most mainstream titles just concentrate on PvP multiplayer.
By the way, you know what? I should have said Cthulhu Saves the World. No, actually, I'm sorry. The developers of Cthulhu Saves the World, Zeboid Games, they did both Penny Arcade games, the Penny Arcade 3 and 4. So I guess that would be my answer that's closer to not, you know, the one I gave was almost exactly a year ago.
Candlejack is such a lame meme. Look, I said Candlejack and I'm still here. It's not like I'm making fun of Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, ex-KGB bosses can be scary. Moving on.
From Pavel Predke in Soviet Russia, Candlejack is abducted by you.
Anyway, we are going to move on to the gaming history. And guess what? We have time for it. So we did Knights of the Old Republic as a gaming flashback. But now we're going to get some background about Knights of the Old Republic. Take it away, Jordan.
We haven't done a gaming history in a long time, and basically what gaming history for those
last week.
Well, we're kind of coming back to gaming history.
That's because I was talking about the old, the consoles that were born just over a decade ago. You know, you have the PS2, you have the Dreamcast, you have the Xbox One, you have the GameCube, you know, so. But in this case, it's not a console.
Instead of talking about a specific game, gaming history goes into literally gaming history. So settle down, kids, and consider this your gaming history 101. BioWare recounts getting Star Wars license for Knights of the Old Republic. As Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic turns a decade old, BioWare key figures remember those very early days of securing the Star Wars license to make their dream RPG that would go on to critical acclaim. Lucas Christensen, now a senior writer for Dragon Age Inquisition, remembers, quote, one moment very clearly where BioWare had gathered in a local theater. His fellow devs descended into giddy kids. Christensen was responsible for the Tatooine and Kashyyyk elements in Knights of the Old Republic, which are two iconic worlds in Star Wars lore. He couldn't believe his luck. My scrolling is not working. I remember one moment very clearly, he recalled, reports Eurogamer. It was the day we secured the license for certain, 100%. The papers are signed, and it's a go. We gathered in a local theater for a company meeting, and up on the screen came the BioWare logo and the Star Wars logo. Pause. And then it started. Of course it started. You couldn't stop it. A room full of suddenly children all humming the Imperial March. KOTOR would release as an exclusive for the original Xbox. There I was, writing the early history of a setting I had grown up with. I went deep on all the lore I could, seeding everything with as many hints forward as I could. That was the challenge, trying to create a history that could lead to the setting I had come to love. Once the initial sugar high rush wore off, some suddenly realized the gravity of the situation, like Derek Watts, the director for Mass Effect, which was largely inspired by KOTOR. Quote, I couldn't believe it, said Watts, referring to his appointment as art director by Casey Hudson for the new Star Wars RPG. I accepted, then I couldn't sleep for 2 weeks, stressing about how the hell I was going to do the job. BioWare Studio creative director James Olin, also game director on Star Wars The Old Republic, had posted a lengthy 10 years later piece on the official Star Wars The Old Republic blog. Back in 2006, when we first discussed doing an MMORPG, we threw around a lot of different ideas. We wrote up pitches for a number of other very popular intellectual properties. Some pitches never made it past BioWare, while others went a little further, wrote Olin. We eventually decided on a Star Wars massively multiplayer online RPG set in the Old Republic era. Why? It was clear that Star Wars The Old Republic was what our fans wanted, and the obvious best choice, Knights of the Old Republic, is just one of the games that defined what BioWare is to modern fans. It didn't just influence Star Wars The Old Republic. Most of the team that worked on it went on to create the Mass Effect franchise. He reasoned that the Star Wars IP is a natural fit for RPGs. His team decided that they had to take crucial elements for KOTOR, epic storytelling in the Old Republic era, cinematic storytelling, the internal struggle between good and evil, becoming a Jedi, owning your own Millennium Falcon-inspired starship, traveling to many other different worlds, and adventuring with companion characters that you actually cared about. Star Wars The Old Republic has now become the primary representation of the Old Republic era to fans. Millions and millions of people have played it, generating millions of hours of gameplay, he continued. Thousands of new fans try out the game every single month. It has provided more content and stories than all of the Star Wars movies and TV series combined until the launch of the new Battlefront game, and I'm just as excited as the rest of you are about DICE creating a new Battlefront game. Star Wars The Old Republic will be the primary core interactive experience in the Star Wars universe. BioWare is selling a KOTOR-related player title in the cartel market to mark the occasion. Currently, BioWare is working on Dragon Age Inquisition for the next and the next Mass Effect, both of which have been heavily influenced by KOTOR's style of storytelling. Voice dialogue has become a standard feature in all the studio's RPGs. Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic released on Xbox July 15th, 2003. 10 years ago. Wow.
So I think this game, along with Halo, is one of the most important games for the Xbox. Because remember when Star Wars, before Knights of the Republic was released, everybody said that all the Xbox was a shooter box. You know, exactly. It didn't do RPGs, and this is the first major RPG for it.
More specifically, a Halo box.
Yeah. Well, no, shooter. There were a lot of shooters on it, though. I mean, yeah. But when did you first play KOTOR?
I bought it at launch.
Oh, okay. So we both bought it at launch. Yeah, 10 years ago. And by the way, I will say this. I still play KOTOR on my Xbox 360, so I'm still using the backwards compatibility along with Jade Empire.
I had a freebie copy on Steam that I got at PAX, and I can't say that I've ever played it. But the 360, the original Xbox version, I played the hell out of that game.
Here's the thing: is that that expansion, you know, that DLC, which was rare for at the time, it's still on my original Xbox, and it's the only way I can play that DLC because on the 360 the DLC doesn't work. So if right. I want to play the DLC, I have to bust out the old Xbox. Get the Duke out and so anyway, that leads into the question of the week. What is your favorite role-playing game of all time? I'm pretty sure that at some point in the past this question has been asked, but you know, we're going to ask it again because it's in the moment. So Jordan, what is your favorite RPG of all time? And by the way, I mean a classic RPG. So please don't all those melds like Deus Ex, I'm not going to accept. You know, it has to be an actual RPG.
A solid RPG. The one that I clocked the most amount of time on, the one that I spent in one sitting playing for 36 hours straight, was Ultima 4.
Mm. Okay. I mean, I did the same thing. And I loved Ultima 4 to death, even though it cost $84 when it was released. And that was in 1984 money. I am not going to say...
There have been many other role-playing games since then that have gotten my attention. The Suikoden titles for the original PlayStation, which I still have sitting here, are fantastic. The Phantasy Star games, of course. Yeah, well, Phantasy Star from the Master System forward are all fantastic.
Stop cheating. You know, I said one. Okay.
But Ultima 4. Yeah. Ultima 4.
Yeah, I would actually go with a recent RPG, and that is, I'm going to go with Mass Effect 2, the second one, because that one took all the elements that were great from the first one and just refined them so much and made such characters, you know, I mean, the characters in KOTOR were very memorable, but they were archetypes, you know, and there were archetypes in Mass Effect 1, but the ones in Mass Effect 2 bent your expectations in such a way that it was just great to watch. And the dialogues and the decision-making were so good. You know, I mean, I know you don't play Mass Effect 3, but Mass Effect 2 made Mass Effect 3 worth playing.
See, Mass Effect 2 kind of annoyed me in the way the inventory system ran. They had a lot of complaints about the inventory system on 1, so they overly simplified it for 2.
Well, I didn't care about that. You know, as long as you could modify them a little bit and they could shoot, I was fine. I mean, the problem with Mass Effect 1 was that you ended up accumulating 150 weapons and says, no, you can't take any more because you have 150 items on you, which is silly because can you imagine someone lugging around 150 items?
Well, exactly, yeah. Well, they had armor with, like, batteries and stuff.
Yeah, you could hold 20 armors. How is that possible? So, yeah, I mean, you know. But I'm going to have to go with Mass Effect 2. Ultima 4 is more of a for... for nostalgia's sake.
What is your name? What is your job?
Job, name, and health.
Yep.
Yeah. And but I will say the first RPG that I really, really, really got excited about was the Bard's Tale.
The original Bard's Tale games were fantastic.
I mean, I was, you know, just looking at the album cover and it was green and you looked at the back and you saw it in 3D, you know, the 3D movable things. And by the way, the Bard's Tale was directly responsible in my eyes for what became Might and Magic. Although I think Might and Magic came earlier.
I think Might and Magic was more contemporaneous with Ultima, but yeah.
But you know what? Might and Magic was also the first open world game, and people don't seem to realize that. It had a massive world that you could just wander around. But
you know, one that I will point people to, because I'm sure it's on an Abandonware site somewhere, the Gold Box Dungeons & Dragons games from SSI.
That I also was excited at, but you know what? They were basically Bard's Tale set in AD&D, you know?
Well, they weren't. They were your party was actually represented as individual icons on the battle screen. So, you know, it was like playing a computer version of miniatures, and very well done.
Okay, you know, we're going to keep on going with this because, you know, F1, we're short on time, but also shall I make one phrase that'll make you immediately know what I'm talking about? You know, he exploded like a blood sausage.
Wasteland.
Yes. And the thing I loved about Wasteland was the book that it came with.
Yes.
The paragraphs, which was a really clever way of doing copy protection.
And Wasteland 2 will be joining us in October.
You know, Shadowrun Returns is going to be joining us next week because they just sent out the Steam codes for that.
Nice.
Yeah, so, and the thing is, I backed Shadowrun Returns for no other reason that I just wanted the IP to succeed. So I don't have a lot of, but I know a lot of people really have a fondness for the old console Shadowrun. What console was it? The SNES or no? Was it a Sega console game?
I want to say it was the Genesis had Shadowrun.
I mean, also, you know, when I first played Daggerfall, my jaw dropped because you could do anything you wanted in it. You know. I mean, it was sort of an illusion, but the fact that you could create your own class was mind-blowing to me. Speaking of Origin, I don't know if you can consider this an RPG. I think I will. And the one game that I spent hours and hours and hours on, and I never got really far in it because I would always die, but one of my favorite RPGs was Autoduel.
Yes.
And
based on the Steve Jackson board game Car Wars.
Now, the thing is that if Steve Jackson wasn't such a prick, we would have had other Car Wars games out there. But unfortunately, Steve Jackson is a total prick. And, you know, he tries to, you know, make as much money for himself as possible, unreasonably so. So publishers just say, oh, forget it. We're not going to deal with this guy. It's
well,
that we haven't had a good and that's what happened, by the way. That's what happened with Fallout, why it was the special system instead of the GURP system, because Steve Jackson was a prick. So they said, we're not going to deal with this guy anymore. So instead of using the GURP system, they created the special system just to f*** him over, you know, because he was just such a prick.
Well, and KOTOR was based on D20 rules.
Yeah, the Star Wars D20, yes.
Yeah.
Anyways, we gave you a whole crap ton, and notice I managed to work in Fallout, even though I completely forgot about it. By the way, I could never get far in Fallout, so I wasn't as big a fan until Fallout 3 came out. And like I said, I've really burned out on those open world 3D games, you know, the Elder Scrolls and Fallout. And Fallout 4 is such an open secret right now. I mean, it's just a matter of you know, announcing it.
Maybe it'll be at Gamescom.
It probably will be. Look for our show notes at gamingpodcast.net, along with industry news and our gaming history articles. We enjoy your feedback, so leave us comments at our blog at gamingpodcast.net. Also, hit us up at facebook.com/gamingpodcast or the forums at gamingpodcast.net/forum or send us comments to fans at gamingpodcast.net. You can also check out our gaming news at gamestudio.com, and you can subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us some iTunes comments.
Yay, iTunes comments.
So, yeah, RPGs, come on. I'm pretty sure, and you have one that's really sticking out in your head. I could be cruel and say no JRPGs, but you know, I will say this: my favorite JRPG remains Blue Dragon.
Blue Dragon was all right. I don't think it was a fantastic JRPG. I've played better, but it was all right.
I have a feeling that Paul would be piping up either The Legend of Zelda or Kingdom Hearts.
Kingdom Hearts. He would be
Final Fantasy VII.
All about Kingdom Hearts.
Or Final Fantasy VII, because he didn't. Or no, actually, he loved Final Fantasy X, if I remember.
Oh, can I give you one last little piece of news? Something that you overlooked, because you mentioned previously that the Vita was outselling the Wii U in Japan.
Yeah.
Apparently, the Xbox 360 is outselling the Wii U in Japan.
Yeah, I love how Microsoft is saying, we're not going to bother.
Sorry, man. Xbox 360 games are outselling Wii U games by 24-1 in Japan.
Well, yeah, but that's the actual number, 24 yeah. games to one game. It's not a ratio. It's not a ratio. It's the actual number.
Probably true.
So anyways, I mean, you know, by the way, when I mentioned Blue Dragon was a big hit in Japan, and it did actually move 360s there.
It did, yeah.
And it was actually
there was a cartoon, there was another JRPG that, at the same time that was better, and I'm blank. Lost Odyssey was good, but there's another one that I'm trying to remember the name
of. The one Tales of game for the Xbox 360?
Say it started with an I.
Oh. You know, by the way,
I got all 1,000 gamer points on that game, but That's all I remember about it.
You know, the one thing about Lost Odyssey was it had a brilliant commercial using White Rabbit from Starship, Jefferson Airplane. That was that told the story of the entire game right there. If you remember
that. I don't remember that at all.
Really? Okay, so why don't you go do a Google search for Lost Odyssey and White Rabbit, and you'll see it's hard. It's impossible. It lasted with me, you know. I mean, it was.
Yeah.
It was. I think it wasn't as equal as Gears of War and Wide World, Mad World, but you know. You know what? Actually, that's going to be next week's question. What was your favorite video game commercial or trailer?
Infinite Undiscovery.
I also played that as well. It was very intriguing, but the problem with that game was that, you know, it's a grinder as well, and when I hit the one boss and I couldn't get past it, I said, "Fuck it, I am out."
See, that's the problem I had in Lost Odyssey. I got to the point where I was captured and thrown in prison, and I never got past
that far. I couldn't get past that big griffin, you know, because I'm not a grinder. And that's what ruined my experience with Lost. And by the way, I got really far in Blue Dragon, which is, you know, which says something considering my attitude towards JRPGs, you know.
Yeah.
Because to me, they're all about spiky-haired kids with tattered clothes and spunky names and names that are named after weather patterns.
Ambiguous sexuality, yes.
Yeah. You know, and also black guys with big afros, especially one in Final Fantasy XIII who actually kept the chocobo in his hair.
Yes.
So, I mean, you know, the thing is, you know, and despite my hatred of Final Fantasy games, I still have a place in my heart for chocobos. Still because of the word chocobo.
Chocobo. Beep. In the Fantasy Star games, they were called Rappies.
Oh, crap. By the way, JRPGs, I almost forgot Baldur's Gate. And the reason why I remember that is because I remember Minsk and Boo, you know, and him telling Boo, "Go for the eyes, Boo! Go for the eyes!" You'd have to play it for that to make it. Everybody loved Minsk because he was big and stupid, and his idea of solving problems was just beat the shit out of it. And he was lawful good.
Well, doesn't that work for most problems?
That was his problem. At one point, he said, "Listen, can we stop talking and just start pounding? Because I'm getting bored here."
Less talking, more hitting.
Sort of like the good version of HK-47. That's another question, actually. What is your favorite JRPG character? Quickly, Jordan, which one?
I don't know. They all look the same after a while.
Really? Not Darth Revan or come on, HK-47.
You said JRPG.
No, just any RPG. Your favorite character in any RPG.
I don't know. I've played too many to pick one out.
If you said Three Dog, I was going to slap you.
Three Dog! Ow!
I always liked Zar from Baldur's Gate because he was insane. And one character actually says...
Oh, it doesn't count as a role-playing game, but I'm going to call it out anyway because it's role-playing-like. It's enough like a role-playing game to say my favorite character, Tiny Tina.
Oh, from Borderlands 2.
Yeah.
Not Mad Moxie?
Not Mad Moxie. Tiny Tina.
Okay. What happens is that one character actually says to Czar, "You're amusing, in a what-the-hell-is-wrong-with-you kind of way." you can use that line. Anyways, see you next week, and let us know what your favorite RPG of all time is.
One pill makes you larger, and one pill makes you small. And the ones that mother gives you don't do anything at all. Go ask Alice when she's 10 feet tall. Chasing rabbits.